Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777. Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a show about gardening, agriculture, and local habitat. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. This episode is a little bit different than normal. I've been out of state for the last 2 weeks, and so Homer Grown's co-producer, Nicola Revelo, conducted the interviews for this episode. KBBI's general manager, Josh Crone, helped with some of the audio engineering as well as some of the editing. And then I came back and threw it all together. For this episode, Nicole talks to Kyra Wagner, the manager of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, and Monica Kopp, the new agriculture program manager for Homer Soil and Water. Bryce Wrigley, the owner and operator of Wrigley Farms and the district manager for the Salcha Delta Soil and Water Conservation District, talks with Nicole. And we have a visit from Jessica Sharp, the Homer Soil and Water's soils person. Today we're talking about cover crops.
So hi, Nicole Revelo here. I am sitting with Monica Kopp and Kyra Wagner from the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. Okay, so Kyra and Monica, we are here today to talk about the cover crop trial that Homer Soil and Water is participating in, and this is a statewide project. Can you explain why the Alaskan Soil and Water Conservation Districts are undergoing a cover crop project?
That's a great question. It's been a long time coming. Soil and water districts have always worked with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, the NRCS, and it's been going on since the Dust Bowl in the 20s when all of the soil was getting washed away. The NRCS, at the time it was called the Soil Conservation Service, got started and started telling farmers how to save their soils. And farmers didn't like to be told by the federal government how to take care of their soils. So local districts were created. Soil and water conservation districts always have a board of local landowners that have representation for the area, and they work as a go-between between the federal programs and the farmers, telling them what the feds have got going on, but as well letting the federal level know what's happening locally and what people's needs are locally. So fast forward to 2020 instead of 1920, and you have a lot more information. We really know how to take care of our soils. We understand so much more about soil health and how soils interact, what they do at different climates, and all of that kind of thing. If you're a farmer down in Lower 48 and you want to plant a cover crop, NRCS has cover crop calculators that they have developed where you can put in your region and your area, and it'll tell you how different cover crops grow in your area, explain to you which ones would be most appropriate for your use and your place and your farm and whatever kind of use you want to have it for. And yet, if you're an Alaskan farmer, there's no data for you because we've never actually sat down and grown a bunch of cover crops and watched how they grew and seen if they did any better in any particular area. Alaska's a huge state, so you can't have any one piece of data for one area. So last year, NRCS has been working with soil conservation districts around the state to do those hands-on plots around the state, planting several cover crops and different trials. in places as far away as Fairbanks, down to Copper Center, Palmer, and a couple here on the peninsula. We have one up in Kenai that was planted early to see what happens when you plant an early season cover crop. And here in Homer, we're planting the late season cover crop for our region to see what they grow like when they're planted later.
So for the listeners who aren't 100% familiar with cover crops, what is a cover crop and why would you plant this?
Good question. And this is one of the things that I love about NRCS. It's really the only U.S. governmental agency I know of that supports this kind of agriculture. It's really innovative. It's not your typical large-scale agriculture. It's really just kind of grabbing hold in the United States in fairly recent years. So a cover crop is not a crop that you sell for sale, and it's not a crop that is going to necessarily give you any kind of production benefits as far as like your bottom line, except it's improving your soil. And it is super vital for any crop to have the best soil possible. So there are different ways you can use plants in your soil besides just harvesting from it. If you plant, say, lettuce, and then you have time in the season when things could grow, rather than letting the weeds grow there, you can grow a cover crop. There are different kinds. I like to think of it as kind of three different classifications of ways that you might use them. Things that have a lot of roots, grasses, oats, barley, things like that, rye, grass, that is often used as a cover crop when you're worried about soil erosion. They have dense roots and they keep a good coverage on the surface of your soil. They also add carbon and things like that to your soil. So that's one option. Another option is a kind of root crop, something like a turnip or a radish, or like a daikon radish is often used as a cover crop. Those kind of crops that have deeper roots can break your soils up deeper down and bring up nutrients and minerals from deeper down as well. So those have their own form of benefit, and they also leave a lot of organic matter in your soil. The third kind is legumes, and these are most commonly known and often the most used. They are like your peas or your vetches or your beans. Those kind of crops, not only do they add nitrogen to your soil because they're nitrogen fixers, they also tend to be plants that can kind of creep and crawl and grab onto other plants, so they often keep weeds down better and do weed suppression pretty well. But the cover crops we've got going on in our trial, we have quite a list that are being experimented with.
Okay, so can you explain why having these dense roots, when you're planting these oats and these grasses that have dense roots, why is that helping my soil?
Yeah, so kind of ties into the four principles of soil health, which are minimize disturbance, maximize living cover, maximize biodiversity, and maximize continuous living roots. And so by having cover crops growing in your soil, you have active plants that are cycling nutrients and feeding microbes and just continuing that cycle of life in your soil, versus when you had, if you didn't have anything growing there, the soil's just drying out, microbes are probably dying, a lot less going on in the soil. So some of the other things that cover crops do are just increase the diversity of things that are growing, increasing the diversity of food for microbes in the soil, armoring the soil surface, decreasing erosion, keeping wind from blowing your soil away or water from running soil out of your field. It also increases water availability and infiltration by sustaining soil aggregates.
You totally should tell about soil aggregates. This is really exciting. All of us dirt nerds, yeah, we love to hear this story.
So what are soil aggregates? They are, if you take a clod of dirt that kind of holds itself together, it is probably full of a lot of roots that are helping hold that together. And the aggregates are actually the little crumbles of soil inside that clod that are essentially glue that has been produced by microbes.
The way I see soil aggregates is a kind of a system, a network in your soil. So We get a lot of questions about people who want to rototill or don't rototill. Should we till or should we not till? And no-till farming is a pretty new concept, kind of like cover crops in general. What we've learned about the science of soil aggregates is actually one of the reasons why that's such a huge thing now, right? So when you don't till, you keep that structure together. And so that soil cluster clumpiness factor that is basically kind of glue of that's left behind from the microbes, those sugars and everything that holds that soil together, that's how you know you have a live soil. And so that kind of, that visual is what the slake test does. It shows you how well your soil's holding itself together. Yeah, so that cluster of living material, all of that organic material in mixed in with your dirt, your minerals, your solid matter, all of that that's holding it together creates your live soils. Every time you break that up, you're breaking it down and you're causing it to decay faster and disappear more readily. Things like nitrogen, that is a very volatile little nutrient. It can go away in water, it can go away in air. So every time you're tilling or breaking your soils, you do run the risk of breaking down your soils, literally. So trying to keep that soil health up is measured often by how much aggregate does your soil have.
Yeah, let's go a little deeper there. So Monica, you know, we're talking about soil aggregates. What is in soil? Like, what is in these aggregates? What comprises a soil clump?
Yeah, so there's living roots. That's a really big part of it. And there's mycorrhiza that live on those roots. And then there is a whole host of organisms that live off of all the other things that are going on in that soil. So you've got nematodes and worms and beetles and all sorts of larvae, and they're all feeding off of mycorrhiza and the roots and each other. And the more diversity you have, the more your soil can sustain. It's absorbing better water and it's not evaporating as fast.
It also helps all of those living critters in your soil really help move nutrients and water around in your soil. So not only is it creating little gaps in between the pockets of minerals and things like that, but so you get movement, but all of those canals aren't just for the movement of a like actual water molecule. It's movement for a bug that carries water and then it dies over there. And then it gets eaten by somebody else, and then it moves over there. And so those nutrients are now, you know, it moves things through your soil on a regular basis. So it makes live soil.
So you guys are explaining kind of the structure of soil. And so we're looking at soil isn't just ground up rocks. It's not just some sand. So we're looking at in a clump of soil, you've got ground up rocks. You've got pieces of sand. You've got not ground up rocks. You've got dying and decaying plant leaves, stems, roots, living roots, insects, nematodes, fungi, which are also known as the mycorrhizae, spreading around and create and their filaments filtering all through the whole system, networking together. And so all of these things are helping, the microorganisms are helping transport nutrients through the passageways that are built by the roots and the fungi around so that other plants can get at them, and then those plants die? Is that what you're saying?
All of this is creating living soil. That's really what matters. And so your roots that come into this, whether you planted them or they were a seed from a bird, that root that goes down into that soil needs to have water and minerals and nutrients. And so if you have a more living soil, then it will have more access to that organic matter that it can get attached to and grow itself. So if you're planting a garden or you're planting a farm, you want to have as living soil as you can manage.
Very cool. Once you've planted these cover crops so as to have your soil not just be bare of plant matter, what do you do with them? Do you leave them there to decay, or are you harvesting them and taking them off?
Yeah, so it's actually pretty important to terminate your cover crops at a certain time, because if you let them grow so much that they flower and go to seed, they can actually kind of switch from contributing to the soil to actually taking away from the soil. And so it's important to terminate your cover crops, and all cover crops have slightly different times when you terminate them. But generally, and what we're doing in this study, is terminating at 50% flowering or 8 weeks of growth, whichever comes first. A good way to terminate is to cut the cover crops and then allow them to rest on the surface as a plant residue and then decompose, and all of those nutrients can go back into the soil and cycle back through and be available for plants in the spring. So there's lots of different methods that you can use to terminate cover crops. On a larger scale, people use flail mowers and brush hogs. You can use a rototiller, but you want to be a little bit careful with rototilling too much, especially in the fall. But one really great way that I recently learned for small-scale cover crops is just a weed whacker. You can just go out there and weed whack and then leave all the residue on the surface.
The first thing you said was a flail mower? What is that?
A flail mower is a small tractor implement. I believe you can also get them for like BCS two-wheel tractors. And it's also the same thing they use to clear brush on the sides of the roads. That is a giant flail mower.
You had said that letting the cover crops go to flower, go to seed, is actually can be detrimental to the soil health. Why is that?
Well, as a plant flowers and produces seeds, it needs more nutrients or more energy from the ground. So it's going to pull nutrients out of the ground to produce that little energy packet that is a seed. So you just want to cut them off before they start producing a seed.
Another thing about that is that a lot of these cover crops are just meant to be a little blip in time in between your main crops. And if you let it go to seed, a lot of them are annuals, and they're very vivacious about replanting themselves. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that you stop it, not only before it starts eating up all your nutrients, but before it goes to seed.
So if the plant went to seed, ate up all your nutrients, and then was left there to decompose, would those nutrients not be made as available as if they were in a younger state then?
It's more the worry about the seed. I think you could once they've gone to seed and you cut them down, then they'll just grow there again. So not only have they eaten up your nitrogen, and remember, nitrogen is very volatile. So like as soon as...
So the nitrogen's in the seed then.
Well, it can also end up being in the air. They can respirate a lot of it. Well, they're using a lot of this.
Right.
So when they pull it up and take it out, it could go anywhere. So it's just good to stop before they get to their seed.
Kyra, you had mentioned nitrogen fixation. Can you explain that for our listeners?
Sure.
How that works?
Yeah, it's an awesome process of symbiosis. So there are very specific bacteria that need an anaerobic environment to produce nitrogen. And that is their off gas. They will produce nitrogen for you, but it needs to be in an anaerobic system. So when they're just running around in the soil, they're not making it so that any particular plant can get a hold of that nitrogen. It's loose and it can get washed away in water or air. But certain plants, like legumes, have an actual chamber on their roots. They're little balls you can see when you pull them up. They'll have little chambers on their roots that hold these bacteria inside, and there is no oxygen in that little chamber. And all of the nitrogen that those little microbes create stays with the plant. And so the plant, as it breaks down, can leave that nitrogen fixed in the soil. I don't know what these bacteria do. All I know is that there's nitrogen-fixing bacteria. I really don't know what a nitrogen like what kind of factory their little body is. I just know that they fart out nitrogen. We don't. So I can't get there for you.
I think that it has something to do with sunlight and carbon as well.
Exactly, because they're living off the plants. They get it's a symbiotic relationship where they get a little home and they get fed by the plant and they create nitrogen that makes the plant happy. There are lots of plants though that actually house nitrogen fixing bacteria that don't have those nodes. Like plants like broccoli, they're actually a little bit allelopathic. And so they put off a chemical from their roots that makes other plants not want to be anywhere near them. And it also makes it so that other bacteria might not want to be around there. So since broccoli don't like to have other plants near them, that means a nitrogen-fixing plant won't be near them. They're not going to have a lot of beans crowding around them. So how are they going to get a legume to fix nitrogen for them if they don't have it? Well, scientists have found that broccoli roots actually have little tiny, almost microscopic cracks and fissures in them. And the broccoli plant itself releases a kind of mucilage that encases those cracks almost as if it was not bleeding, but leaving a gooey, pasty kind of liquid in those cracks. And the bacteria can burrow down in that and have their anaerobic oxygen-free environment. And so broccoli actually harbors its own nitrogen-fixing bacteria, which I find fascinating. So all of these relationships are to try and get very specific bacteria to come and live with them. And if you have a really diverse crop, set of crops that go through your soil, you will just amplify all the different kinds of bacteria and the different kinds of relationships that these plants can have.
Wow, that's really cool. Monica, can you talk to us a little bit about what kinds of plants are being planted as cover crops in this trial, and you know, what are people using for this?
Yeah, so we are actually growing 23 different varieties of cover crops in this field out East End Road. There are several different types of oats, barley, triticale, rye, mustard, turnip, collards, radishes, flax, which I've never seen flax growing before. Kind of cool. Sunflower, have to say that one's not doing very well. Red clover and peas, as well as buckwheat.
We're doing four different repeats of each one. So there's actually 92 plots out there for these 23 varieties. And there's a water and a temperature gauge as well out there, so we can have a long-term record of what's going on as far as that input goes. So next year when we do it again, if it's a very different summer, like this summer was very cool, next summer might be very different, so we might have very different data. And so we'll be able to say on hot summers they grow like this, and on cold summers they grow like that.
If I recall correctly, Monica, then you guys are growing three different kinds of different categories of plants in these 23 varieties, right?
Correct, yeah. So we've got our grasses, which are the oats, barley, rye, and triticale. We have brassicas, which are the radish and turnips and collards. And we have legumes, which are the clovers and peas. We're also growing sunflower, flax, and buckwheat, which are kind of anomalies.
And so those legumes that you just listed off are your nitrogen fixers, and then your grasses are the ones that are going to have mm-hmm. large kind of surface root systems, and the radishes will burrow down and break up soil. The other brassicas are mostly there then for just adding nutrient content to the surface.
Yeah, and Kyra actually hit on this too with the brassicas being allelopathic. They actually have weed suppressing qualities as well, and we can actually see that out in the field. Some of the plots are pretty weedy and others are not, and those turnips and radishes are really crowding out all of the weeds, which is really cool.
That is really cool. Where is this trial being conducted?
It's out East End Road, about 7 miles, I want to say. It's on Daryl and Rita Walker's hay ground. Thank you, Daryl and Rita, for allowing us to do this. It's the driveway right past the golf course if you're headed from town. And on September 8th, we are going to be having a field day. So we will be out there giving demonstrations and showing people what's growing and explaining, answering questions and things like that. So it's all for anyone to see out there.
Oh, cool. So people on September 8th, what times?
We will be there most of the day, so 10 to 6:30. If somebody wants to drop by, feel free. It'll be a good day for lots of cover crop and soil geeking out.
So
tons
for,
of information.
For listeners out there, you can show up at Rita Walker's farm, her hay farm, and go see these for yourself. See them live in action before they are terminated all day. You can just drive there, park there. The public is fully welcome. So I'd like to move on to another question. So, you know, local growers who are curious can see this trial in action. And from this trial, we will have data from different locations around the state. Let's say you wanted to get started now. Let's say you didn't want to wait for that data to come out. How do people get the seeds? What would be the process you guys would recommend for someone who wants to get started with cover crops in their life?
Well, there's first step is always the seed. So depending on where you plan to use it and how you plan to use it, we have our local stores here do sell cover crop seed. So I know at the Wagon Wheel, they've got different kinds that you can purchase from grasses as well as legumes. Also places around the state like Alaska Mill and Feed has cover crop mixes. It's usually designed for erosion. And then there are also tons of catalogs that you can order from while you're dreaming about your gardens in the wintertime and you get your Johnny's catalog or your Peaceful Valley catalog. They'll have entire sections on cover crops. So it's usually for small scale farmers just because it's where it's really taken off. But there are large scale versions of it as well. I know that there are a couple of farmers in the state who have become quite advocates of no-till farming and trying cover crops. So,
yeah, so the cool thing about cover crops is they're really easy to grow. And once you get your hands on some seeds, you know, go to the garden store and just ask for some recommendations, or you can do a little research on your own. There's lots of resources available online. But once you get your cover crop seeds, you can pretty much just scatter them wherever you're not growing anything. And personally, I have a 50-pound bag of field peas, and I just scatter them wherever I feel like it. And you know, water them in until they germinate, and really you don't have to water again after that unless it's super dry. So they're super easy and just take care of themselves, and then you just terminate them when the time comes with your weed whacker. Or another great way is with chickens, or adding, you know, letting sheep into a field, or goats, and they will also do a great job of cycling the nutrients themselves.
So they're low maintenance, and it sounds like there's no specific planting date that you really need to hold to, because you're looking for something along a 2-month growth period, more or less.
Yeah, more or less. Some rule of thumb dates that I have had recommended to me was August 15th. Don't plant any later than August 15th outdoors, or September 15th in a high tunnel. And I would definitely recommend early season cover crops as well. You know, planting as soon as you can work the soil before you set out your tomatoes and peppers on June 1st. That's another great window. You could plant as early as mid-April, possibly.
Oh, that's cool to know. So for those who are really eager about succession planting, right? So you're staggering your crops. This is something you could do early in the season before you start planting those mid-season salad greens or bok choys or whatever.
Definitely, yeah.
Okay, so I have been asked to ask you gals about the slake test. This is some really cool way of explaining soil structure to people. Who wants to take that on?
I can. Yeah, the slake test, I just personally watched a video of it for the first time a couple weeks ago in a soil health class I was in. Essentially, you have two beakers that are full of water, and you would want two different soils. So hopefully one that you know is like pretty good soil and another that is a little bit more degraded. And those beakers have a little shelf with a bunch of holes in them. And you put your clods of dirt on that shelf, and the water soaks into the dirt, and you can watch what happens. And a soil with good aggregate quality is going to stay together. It's going to absorb the water, and really the water doesn't change color at all. a degraded soil that does not have good aggregate structure is going to immediately start dissolving, and it just, you watch it cascade down this beaker in the water and turn all of the water muddy brown. So that is the slake test. We hope to have the supplies to do that on the field day. So if you want to see it in person, come out to the cover crop field day.
The slake test is a miniature version of what happens all around the planet when it rains. Basically, I know I lived in South America for 4 years, and I thought all tropical water was brown. And really, it was just that I was in an area that was heavily deforested, and they were losing their soils constantly. But that's one of the reasons, going back to the beginning where I said NRCS got started because of the Dust Bowl, it was how do you keep your soils from blowing away or washing away? So the more aggregate you have, the more you're going to be able to keep your soil in place and the better your soil health. And that's the whole goal of the whole game.
Well, Kyra, Monica, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show and speaking with us about soil health and the cover crop trials that, again, people can go out and visit on September 8th. If you have any questions about the field day, you can reach out to myself via email at nicole@homerswcd.org or to Monica, M-O-N-I-C-A @homerswcd.org. Ta-da!
And that was Homer Soil and Water Conservation District Manager Kyra Wagner and Agriculture Program Manager Monica Kopp. That interview was conducted September 2nd, 2021. Coming up next, Nicole Arevalo talks with Bryce Wrigley, the owner and operator of Wrigley Farms and District Manager for the Salcha Delta Soil and Water Conservation District.
Hello, we are speaking today with Bryce Wrigley of Wrigley Farms, who listeners may better know as the Alaska Flower Company. The Alaska Flower Company has products locally sold here in Homer at Saviemore and in other stores around the state. And Bryce, to get started, I'd love it if you could introduce your farm and what you guys do there.
Yeah, thank you. Our farm is named Wrigley Farms. We do business as Alaska Flower Company. We raise barley. We've raised barley since about 1984. And then in 2011, we started raising hullus barley and built a flour mill. And since then have been selling products like barley flour, cereal, couscous, different mixes and stuff, all based with barley.
All right, that's the pancake mix we can find in the store. And how many acres is your farm?
Our farm is 1,700 acres, about a third of it is in grass, hay, about a third of it we plant each year, and about a third of it is fallow. And so as we plant our cover crops, a few years ago we started using our fallow ground for cover crops to try and build the soil during that resting year.
And you're located in Delta Junction, right?
That's correct, down the Alaska Highway.
So Bryce, we've brought you here today to talk a little bit about the value of no-till farming. I understand that you used to grow with more conventional farming methods and that you made a transition. So if you could please tell us about that, that'd be wonderful.
The ground we farm up here in Delta was recently cleared. I mean, you know, 30 years ago is recent. It takes a long time for sticks and stuff to break down. So during that period of breakdown and clearing it, you have to really use a disc or something to chop pieces up in small pieces, wood up into small pieces and roots. And so we did that. Everybody else did that. My kids helped me. It took us years ago. It took us about, well, it took seven people to plant a crop. We had somebody on six different pieces of equipment and then somebody else chasing fertilizer and seed. So yeah, it was somebody fertilizing and somebody disking and somebody packing and somebody drilling, a couple drills. And so it just took a lot of people. And then my kids started leaving for college and getting married and leaving home, and it became difficult to find tractor drivers. And about that time started reading more about no tillage, and it seemed like a way of addressing that labor shortage. So we switched over to no till, which it was really interesting because the year before we switched to no till, again it took a whole bunch of us to plant the crop, and then 1 year later I planted the whole crop myself. with just one piece of equipment in the field. Yeah, I was a little concerned about how well it would work. Colder soils and having cover on the ground, residue left on the ground, would potentially make those soils warm up a little later in the spring. But since we started no-tilling, have not had any problems. And frankly, I would not go back to conventional tilling right now. The benefits we see from no-tillage are just immense. The savings in soil moisture alone is unbelievable. The year we started no-tilling, that year we really depend on spring rains to bring the crop up here. And sometimes those spring rains are delayed. That year we started no-tilling was one of those years. Normally we get rain around the end of May, right after planting, the crop comes up evenly. That year we didn't get any rain until about the third week of June. And so we had uneven emergence on any fields that were conventionally tilled. So I went out in the field, and it was about the third week of June, just before it started raining, a little concerned because I'd seen some of the neighbors and crops didn't look very good. So I went down the field, and we had conventionally tilled one field. And I looked in that field, and the crops were kind of just uneven, didn't look very good, not very, you couldn't see down a row, patches where nothing was coming up. And I dug down in there, and there was seed there, but the seed was down about an inch, and the moisture level was down about 2.5 inches. So it was just waiting for rain. And I went over to the fields that we had no-tilled, and gosh, the grain was up. You could see down the rows, it was all even. So I just bent down and flicked my finger through the residue, a bunch of residue on the ground. And immediately under that residue was moisture. And that just really made me a believer. The no-tillage, yeah, we haven't had any dust ever come off the fields since we started no-tilling. Like when we get a lot of wind up here, never see any dust leave the farm. I don't worry about whether we're gonna have a late rain or not. We had even drilled an irrigation well to irrigate the crop up so that we had even emergence. Because if you don't get even emergence, then you fight it at harvest time real bad. Gosh, since we started no-tilling, we haven't even turned the well on. So yeah, total believer in no-tillage.
Wow, you haven't had to turn on the well at all in this whole time. How many years is this?
That was since 2010 we started no-tilling.
And what prompted the change to no-tilling?
Well, in part, it was the fact that it was just getting hard to find people to drive tractors, and that it took a lot of tractors in the field, pieces of equipment in the field. But as I started looking at no-tillage, I went to a soil health field day or seminar down in Idaho and Washington, down in the Palouse area. Talked with a bunch of people down there, met with some of the people that were sponsoring the field day or the conference. As I began studying on it and thinking about it, it just seemed like there was a lot of things. One of the things that really caught my attention was its ability to conserve soil moisture. But as we got into the no-tillage, a whole bunch of additional benefits that we've learned about and observed. For example, soil organic matter. And down in America, where farming has been the case, conventional farming has been the case for generations, 150, 200 years, and they're looking at between 1 and 2% soil organic matter. Our soil organic matter here ranges between 8 and 12%. And I really wanted to conserve that. Disking and tilling really impacts the soil structure and destroys that soil organic matter. So that's one thing, and that's another thing that the no-tillage preserves for us, is that high organic matter, which is really what conserves that soil moisture, holds that soil moisture.
So Bryce, one of the other hats you wear is as district manager for the Salcha Delta Soil and Water Conservation District, and through that you work with the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service, or better known as NRCS. Is your connection with NRCS part of your no-till program?
It is, yes. In fact, one of the programs NRCS offers is an EQIP program, EQIP, an Environmental Quality Incentives Program. When we decided to go to no-tillage, one of the things that reduced the risk in my mind, remember, I didn't know for sure if this would work. I was really concerned about the ability of the soil to warm up if it had very much residue on it. In the past, we disked it, and then that black soil kind of absorbed radiantly the sun's energy and warmed up and stuff. Of course, that also dries it out. And I didn't know how that would work with no-tillage. And so one of the programs, the EQIP program that NRCS offers, is a cost incentive program where you can try a practice out and they'll fund it or pay a certain amount, which in my mind reduced that risk. In other words, if I tried no tillage and it reduced my yield, I felt like I could make it up with this payment that they offered. So that's what it's called, as an incentive payment. You know, you try this practice, we'll give you an incentive to try it for 3 years, and you can decide if you want to keep it. So that's one of the things that made me decide that I could afford to try it or to risk it. Yeah, we participated in that program for 3 years and really glad. In fact, I've told a lot of people that that program was a game changer for us. If it had not been for the security of being able to ensure that if the crop didn't turn out because of switching our tillage practices, that I could have made some of that back through that program, I don't know if I would have been willing to take that risk. But once that program was ended, yeah, I had no intention ever of going back to conventional tillage.
Are there other NRCS programs your farm participates in?
Yep, we participated in pest management program. We participate in a soil health initiative. And that includes, you know, not only the no-tillage, but also some cover crops. And then there's a series of soil tests that NRCS takes to kind of chart that over time, chart changes to the soil and you know, if it's improving or not. So we participate in those. We're participating in that one right now.
And Salcha Delta Conservation District is also participating in the statewide partnership with NRCS to do cover crop trials around the state. How are your crops going?
We put that on my farm because that was where my equipment was, and I asked any of the other supervisors if they would like to have it on their farm. Nobody raised their hand, so we decided to put it on my farm and use my equipment. And of course, my equipment is no-tillage, so we put in our cover crops as a no-till practice. And yeah, we made some mistakes. We overseeded. Seeding rate was a little heavy on some of the crops, but they came up good. We've had a soil health field day here about a week and a half ago or so, and that turned out really well. A lot of people showed up. I think we had close to 30 people, farmers as well as people from NRCS and state agencies, and got a lot of questions answered. We brought in a speaker from Colorado, a guy named Brendan Rocky, who proposes something he calls biotic farming, the biology of soil and how to enhance that and make sure that it's healthy. So it was a very, very good and interesting, informative field day that we had. It was really a good time. But the crops themselves have done well. A number of the crops that we raised are commonly grown here, you know, several barleys and oats and things like that. And some of the crops we raised in the trial are also crops that we raise in our own cover crop on the farm, some radishes, some turnips, and triticale and things like that. But as I was going down the list of the crops we're raising and kind of taking care of the plots, I realized that this was also an opportunity to kind of get an idea of different crops that are not generally grown here and see how well they perform, with the possibility of, yeah, could some of them become a crop in the future, a rotation crop or something. So that made it kind of interesting as well, something that I hadn't anticipated when we first started talking about the cover crop program. In the cover crop trial, let's see, there were some peas. We have grown peas before. There were a couple different kinds of peas that we raised. Some mustards, which I'd never grown before. So yeah, I think there were a number of crops that certainly they grew, and they would function as cover crops. The question would be, do they mature and set seed that is viable? And so that's something else that I didn't anticipate that being a benefit. But I can see, kind of watching, when we terminated our cover crops, I left some of them growing to see if they would mature and if they would have viable seed. I'd just like to add maybe one more thing about the cover crop trial. Again, at the beginning of the cover crop trial, this wasn't something that was really decided on to do, but it came up just about a week before we had our soil health field day, and that was that the University of Alaska Fairbanks, a researcher from there, decided she wanted to take some soil samples from near the roots of the different cover crops and look for biological activity. So I thought that was interesting. So the day that we had the soil health field day, after that was done, then we went out and collected soil samples from all the cover crops, gave them to her, and she will do whatever she has to do with them, and we'll try and identify any changes or differences in biological activity around the roots, you know, mycorrhizae, fungi, microbes, different things like that, and see if there's differences in the different cover crop species. And then we'll also compare those numbers of those biological entities with kind of a check group, I guess, of an area that was not in cover crops. So that'll be also interesting to see. I don't know if 1 year is enough to build that. I think that there would be some difference, but certainly by the second year, I would think that we would see for sure some differences there.
Great. And these are 2-year trials, so very much looking forward to that. Thank you so much, Bryce, for taking some time out to speak with us down here on the Southern Peninsula, and happy growing this season.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that, Nicole.
And that was Bryce Wrigley, the district manager for the Salcha Delta Soil and Water Conservation District, recorded August 30th, 2021. Coming up next, we hear from Jessica Sharp.
Hi, my name is Jessica Sharp. I work for Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. If you've turned in a soil sample recently, you've probably seen my name come through your emails. I'm the one who does the soil sample analysis and recommendations for everyone who submits soil samples through Homer Soil and Water. Today, I'd like to tell you a little bit about soil health and some things that you can do in your garden or farm to help nourish the soil health. And a lot of times when we're talking about soil health, the idea is seeing it more as a living ecosystem. And the term health just gives you the picture of the soil as being like a living being. And there really are a lot of living creatures within the soil, and they all work together to help improve the soil health. And that in turn makes the soil more productive for your crops. So usually the more diversity that's in the soil, generally the healthier the soil is. And what I mean when I say that it's healthier is it's more productive, it's more stable, and it's more resilient to disturbances. Like, for example, if you had a flood go through your field, or another common disturbance is just tillage. A lot of times when the soil is tilled, it sort of damages the soil, it breaks apart the aggregates, and can damage the microorganisms within it. But if it's a healthy soil, then it can recover more quickly from that. So there's 4 principles that help to conserve the soil ecosystem, and these are things that anyone can do in their own garden or farm to help their soil become more healthy. The first one is to minimize disturbance, and the most common form of disturbance is tillage. So you really want to do that as minimally as possible. It's understandable if you do 1 spring tillage just to get the ground ready and everything before you put your crops in, but repeatedly tilling is going to cause damage to your soil. So we just recommend minimizing tillage and minimizing other things that could disturb the soil, such as using vehicles in the fields and things like that. The second principle is maximizing living cover. So that means maximizing plants. And if you think about what a wild ecosystem looks like, you really don't see very much bare soil. You know, if you're just driving around and you look at the forest and you look at the, you know, even on the side of the road, there's not a whole lot of exposed soil. The plants take over everything. And there's a reason for that. Having the plants on the soil protects it from erosion, provides habitat for animals and microorganisms, and it just keeps the soil in place and helps build it up. To maximize living cover, some things that you can do in your own field include planting cover crops in aisles and around field edges, or at the end of the season, once you've harvested your commercial crops. You can use companion planting to fill in some of the gaps, and planning field layout to maximize space use. So really think about when you're planning your garden for the next season, how can you maximize living cover? So how can you put the most plants possible without causing any problems for your management of the field? The third principle that conserves the soil ecosystem is maximizing biodiversity. So this can be biodiversity of plant life, but it can also be biodiversity of animal life, including different insects and microorganisms, but also integrating livestock is another way to improve biodiversity. So some simple things that people can do are to plan crop rotations to include crops from multiple plant families, use cover crops to diversify plantings, or put in a pollinator garden in a portion of your field. All of those things will improve the biodiversity, which will in turn improve the soil health. The fourth principle that conserves the soil is to maximize continuous living roots. So we don't want to have a bunch of bare soil with no roots in it, because that soil is going to be prone to erosion and compaction and just a deterioration of the soil health. So ways to do that include reducing tillage, using cover crops, and mulching. Mulching is just a really easy way. If you do have a crop, there's a lot of open ground in between them. You can just mulch the soil around it, and that will help the soil roots to spread, to be protected from the elements. And then if there are any areas where you are not going to have crops for the season, then you can put in a cover crop, and those living roots will help nourish the soil. So all of the practices that I described will help the microorganisms in the soil to thrive. And this increases soil organic matter content. It helps with water retention, improves soil structure, and can lead to more productive crops. So I'd like to talk about how this all factors in with your soil tests that you get through Homer Soil and Water. When we do the soil tests, we're mostly looking at chemical properties of the soil, nutrient levels, and things like that. If you have nutrient levels that are off, like they're either too high or too low, then that can cause problems in a couple of these different areas. So not having enough nutrients can lead to stunted plants and difficulty of the plants establishing root systems. If you have too much nutrients, then this can actually become toxic to the microorganisms within the soil. A couple other things we look at with your soil tests are the organic matter level and the cation exchange capacity. And both of these give a pretty good picture of, well, at least a little bit of a picture into your soil health. And so, you know, if you've been adding mulch and you've been using cover crops, your organic matter is going to increase and the cation exchange capacity in your soil is going to increase. And the cation exchange capacity has to do with how easily your soil can hold on to different kinds of nutrients and have them available to the plants. So those are both a good indication of the soil health. There are some different things that you can't really tell from a soil test that are best looked at in the field. And these are things like soil structure, looking at where there's cover on the soil and your farm layout and things like that. So if you'd like to learn more about your soil health in addition to your soil test, we recommend getting a site visit from someone either at Homer Soil and Water or someone at the local NRCS office. And they can help take a look at your soil health and maybe recommend some little ideas that you could implement to help improve that. And that's all I have for the day, so thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of news and tidbits on local agriculture and wild habitat too. Coming up tomorrow, September 5th, 2021, local honey producers Stoked Beekeeping are hosting their second annual Harvest Festival, and funds generated through ticket sales will be donated to local nonprofit, the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. This will be an outdoor event at the Stoked Beekeeping headquarters on Baycrest Hill from 4 to 8 p.m. There will be a pig roast, bee trivia, and a tour of the headquarters, raffle prizes, beverages, and music for dancing. A shuttle will be provided from the Baycrest Lookout over to the Harvest Festival because parking is limited. Tickets are $25 for adults, $15 for kids, and are available at the Homer Farmers Market at the Stoked Beekeeping booth, or you can reach out directly to James Reed from Stoked to reserve one. He can be reached by email at stokedbeekeeping@gmail.com or by phone at 907-538-1061. And, as heard earlier in the show, Homer Soil and Water is hosting our Cover Crops Field Day to offer people from around the community a chance to see the 23 varieties being trialed right here for Alaska's first ever statewide cover crop study. Staff from Homer Soil and Water will be there to share with visitors insights about soil health and to answer your questions about cover crops or soil health more broadly. Visitors can learn about the different types of cover crops and what functions they may offer in your garden soil, in weed and pest suppression, microbial life, nutrient cycling, and how to incorporate them into your own farm or garden. There will also be demonstrations of the soil slake test, which offers a great visualization of how healthy soil and poor soil differ. The field day is happening this Wednesday, September 8th, from 10 a.m. to 6:30 p.m., and people are welcome to swing by anytime. We will be on East End Road, just east of the golf course, at 57060 East End Road. Parking will be at the first driveway east of the golf course, and there will be signage on the road to help direct you to our parking area. All are welcome. Bring a gardening friend and take advantage of this day of learning. Also on September 8th, the UAF Cooperative Extension is offering a very brief and free virtual workshop on the basics of canning, dehydrating, and freezing food for extended storage. They will cover what equipment is needed, safety considerations, and the advantages and limitations of each technique. The Cooperative Extension is also offering a workshop on September 15th titled An Alaskan Gardener's Fall and Winter To-Do List. Both workshops will take place at noon. You can find out more and how to register at www.uaf.edu/ces. And lastly, the public is welcome to join the Homer Drawdown team on September 17th at 6 p.m. for their Peatland Celebration at the Pratt Museum. This will be a celebration of peatlands here on the southern Kenai Peninsula and will showcase the collaborative work of the Homer Drawdown Peatland Project, including Art for Peat, artist-in-residence Cheryl Riley, results of the Peatland Citizen Science Surveys that have been happening this summer, and personal stories, botany talk, music, food, and joy. So head to the Pratt on the 17th to celebrate what this year's Peatlands Project has been cultivating and why peatlands are so important to our local ecosystem. And if you're interested in taking part in the last community peatland survey for the season, you can do that on September 18th. The public is welcome to join this volunteer effort to put peat on the map with community science surveys. Learn to measure the depth of peat, identify plant communities, and enjoy a hands-on experience in the field. Find out more at www.homerdrawdown.info. Until next time.
That's the show. I want to thank Kyra Wagner and Monica Kopp of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, as well as Jessica Sharp, also of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, and Bryce Wrigley, the owner and operator of Wrigley Farms and district manager for the Saucha Delta Soil and Water Conservation District. Thank you to Nicole Arevalo for all of the recordings and interviews, as well as Josh Crone for technical support and some editing help. Local musicians Carly Konomak and Kevin Cope for our intro music. Ryan Black and the band Trial and Terror for music used within this episode. You can find their music on Bandcamp at Trial and Terror and Glacier Maximus. Questions and comments can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer. Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777.